It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about a recording studio in Madison that's recorded some musical legends over the years, including Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins.
First, last night's Democratic debate spotlighted differences between candidates Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton on gun control. The back and forth centered on a law that makes it difficult to sue gun manufacturers and gun stores for damages caused by legally purchased firearms.
The debate came right on the heels of a court decision that moves forward a lawsuit involving the parents of victims in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting against the makers of the rifle used in that attack.
Joining us now to discuss the case is UCLA law professor Adam Winkler. He follows Second Amendment legal issues. His most recent book is Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with a law that's really at the center of this case and this presidential debate, a 2005, I believe, law called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. Can you tell us what that did?
This law was designed by allies of the NRA to prevent lawsuits against gun manufacturers and gun dealers when their guns are used by criminals to commit some crime and cause some damage. In the 1990s, victims of gun violence were suing gun makers and gun dealers, saying that they were negligently putting products into the stream of commerce that they knew were deadly. And the gun makers and the NRA's allies responded by adopting this law, which said, barring exceptional circumstances, and the law lists a couple of those circumstances, these gun makers and gun dealers are immune from liability.
And the case from supporters of this law was that, hey, these are products made legally. These are products sold legally. So people involved in the legal process of making and selling these things shouldn't be liable for someone else's use of them in an illegal way. That was the case for this.
That's right. Some products, when they're designed in a certain way and the manufacturer knows that they're dangerous, sometimes the law imposes liability on them to try to get them to make their products less dangerous. Say a car that doesn't have seatbelts. You want to encourage them to have seatbelts, so you might hold them liable for producing a car without those seatbelts. But with regards to guns, it's the very basic feature of the gun that makes them dangerous. They shoot a powerful projectile at a very high speed, and they're designed to kill someone or injure someone if they are attacking you. So these guns were being used in some ways for their intended use, not in some exceptional way, and the danger that they posed was known by everybody. So is it fair to hold the gun makers liable?
So the upshot is it makes it harder to hold them liable, and yet we have this case yesterday, going back to the Sandy Hook school shooting a few years back, some people, parents of victims, suing the gun manufacturer in maybe an exemption in this law. Can you explain the reasoning that might make their case an exception?
Sure. Well, the law has a few exceptions. It says if gun dealers or gun makers knowingly violate a state or federal law, then they can still be held liable. We saw in Wisconsin there was a case last year, the Badger Guns case, where a gun dealer seemingly knowingly helped someone buy a gun illegally that was then used to shoot some police officers. And Badger Guns, the gun store, was held liable because they had violated the federal laws that prevent that. There are also other grounds. In this case, the main ground is if the gun maker is negligent in producing a firearm, then the immunity law does not cover them. And the plaintiffs here are saying that Bushmaster and Remington were negligent in producing military-style firearms that they knew would be used in things like mass shootings.
In the news yesterday, a Connecticut judge kept this case alive, rejected an effort by the manufacturers here to end the case. But this is not any kind of final decision. This is not a ruling on the merits of this argument over the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. Is that right?
That's right. Yesterday's ruling was a very narrow ruling, a procedural ruling, really, that just said we're going to allow the case to go forward. But it does not mean that the plaintiffs have an easy time ahead of them. This law provides a lot of immunity for these gun makers, and it's still possible that the gun makers will get this case thrown out of court when the court turns its attention to the very merits of the plaintiff's claims.
Talking to Adam Winkler, he's author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, looking at a lawsuit in the case over the Sandy Hook shooting. This also became an issue in the presidential debate last night. And I want to get to that debate now, a few hours after the judge issued this ruling, keeping this case alive. It was raised in the Democratic presidential debate. Gun control issues, a point of difference between Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton. Let's listen to an exchange between those two last night.
Do you owe the Sandy Hook families an apology?
No, I don't think I owe them an apology. They are in court today, and actually they won a preliminary decision today. They have the right to sue, and I support them and anyone else who wants the right to sue.
Well, I believe that the law that Senator Sanders voted for, that I voted against, giving this special protection to gun manufacturers and to dealers, is an absolute abdication of responsibility on the part of those who voted for it. This is a unique gift given to only one industry in the world.
Adam, let's tackle that point. Is this a unique protection for gun sellers and manufacturers, a unique gift, as Hillary Clinton just said?
It is a unique gift in many ways. I think most businesses, when they produce a product that is used as intended, are not going to be held liable. So in that sense, it's not unusual. However, the law does provide more protections for gun industry than you might otherwise have for, say, toy manufacturers or other kinds of products. So there are some differences between what this law provides and what kind of immunity other manufacturers have.
So for a gun manufacturer, if I'm using a firearm and it turns out it's defective, it misfires and injures me somehow, this law wouldn't protect them in that case. That could, I could sue them maybe for negligence if that's the case.
That's right. If this gun goes off and explodes in the shooter's hands and injures someone, say, at a gun range, well, then the gun maker can still be held liable for producing a product that is defective. However, what the law does is say, if that product is used by a third party, or sorry, it does injury to a third party as a result of criminal acts, then there's absolutely no liability. In some other businesses, in some other industries, you might have liability if the manufacturer knew and had reason to know that the product would be used by criminals and would be used to cause harm.
Let's key back in now on this case in Connecticut over the Sandy Hook shootings. As we mentioned, the judge's ruling isn't a ruling really on the merits of the case. It was procedural, as you said. What are you looking for going forward? How likely is it that the court should rule in favor of the families, given the laws we have in place?
I think the families have a very tough road ahead of them. Court after court after court that's ruled on these kinds of cases has tended to find that, barring exceptional circumstances, like in the Badger Guns case, where the gun dealer seemed to purposefully and intentionally break a federal or state law, usually these cases do get kicked out of court at some point or another. I would expect that there's a good chance that that happens in this case, although one never really knows.
Supposing it did go through in the courts, is this just a minor exception to this law we've been talking about, or would this be a crack and we'd expect to see other similar lawsuits proceed?
I think we can expect to see other lawsuits proceed, and if the plaintiffs win this case, it's not just a small crack, but a major victory, because their basic claim is that gun makers made a gun that they knew would be used for criminal activity and cause a lot of damage, and yet, and as a result, they're liable for that. When push comes to shove, every gun maker knows that their guns are going to be used by criminals at some point in time to do harm, and in fact, much more likely to commit harm than one of these Bushmaster or Remington military-style rifles is the ordinary handgun. Are handgun manufacturers going to be liable next? I expect we'll see quite a few more lawsuits if the plaintiffs win this case.
Now, this law we've been talking about passed back in 2005. Has there been any effort to overturn it in Congress or tweak it in any way since then?
There has not been a significant effort to tweak it, although bills have been introduced. You know, Republicans control the House of Representatives, and just as President Obama's proposals for new gun control laws after Newtown back in 2013 found that they couldn't go anywhere with Republicans having the influence that they have in Congress, I think any effort to repeal the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act will face that same hurdle.
And in this case, in the Democratic Democratic presidential debate, these votes by two senators at the time in 2005, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, also Barack Obama for that matter, came back as part of the record to haunt them. Are we going to see this kind of continued scrutiny of how people vote on gun issues?
I think so. You know, one of the big differences between this presidential election and the last few that we've seen is that guns are a major issue in the campaign, especially on the Democratic side. You know, for years, Democratic candidates, including Barack Obama, ran away from the issue of gun control because they thought it was a loser come election day and it was going to cost them votes with independents. What we're seeing since Newtown is a real change in gun control politics. The gun control movement has been reinvigorated, and the Democratic Party views gun control as an electoral winner now.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at the UCLA School of Law, talking about a Connecticut judge's decision yesterday to allow a lawsuit against gun makers to move forward. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on this Food Friday, we'll talk about meatballs, from your classic Swedish meatball to a vegan lentil version.
First, in 2010, Madison Smart Studios closed its doors permanently after decades of success and influence in the music industry. The recording studio was co-founded by producers Butch Vig and Steve Marker, who later founded Madison's own famous rock band, Garbage. In addition to recording scores of local and regional bands, the studio hosted big names like Nirvana, Smashing Pumpkins, and Death Cab for Cutie.
Madison filmmaker Wendy Schneider has spent the last several years creating the Smart Studio Story, documentary that chronicles the history of the now legendary recording studio, and she joins us now. Wendy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It is great to be here.
Well, Wendy, what was the original idea behind Smart Studios when it first started up?
Smart Studios was an outlet for Butch and Steve to record friends of theirs, friends like The Appliances, Butch's band Spooner. They basically built a clubhouse in the Gishalt building on the second floor in a very raw space so that they could have a place to go to kind of drink beer, hang out, and make cassette recordings. That was the beginning of Smart Studios.
Looking at some of the interviews that you did with the musicians who played there over the years, the band members, it sounds as though there was a distinctive sound of Smart Studios, or that they were able to get a sound that other people couldn't. How would you describe that?
I think that I would describe the sound as really unpretentious and organic to the band. I think that's what Butch and Steve were really great at doing, was not manipulating bands to sound anything unlike what they did sound like, but they also worked very hard to sort of extract the best tones and the best performances from those bands. So I think that the Smart sound was really, it was the sound of the music of the time, but it was recorded in a way that was revealed, you know, beautifully to people who listen to those recordings.
And for an indie studio in Madison, Wisconsin, kind of out of the way, the studio had an incredible roster of talent come out of it. Can you run through the list for us a little bit? Who recorded at Smart Studios?
Well, if you go back to some of the local bands, and I'll draw from the film, you know, Tar Babies, The Appliances, The Weeds, Sometimes Why, Fun with Adams, Honor Among Thieves. You know, those were some of the local bands. And then, you know, when you get into bands from Chicago and around the Midwest, like the Chainsaw Kittens, Laughing Hyenas, Smashing Pumpkins, leading up to, you know, the period where Nirvana and Tad, The Fluid, you know, bands from Colorado, Seattle, California, you know, that would be L7. You know, I think that Smart became a destination for bands when studios were really not destinations, nor was Madison, you know? So it's interesting that Smart began to draw a variety of bands from across the country to the Midwest because the music that Butch and Steve were recording was getting out and being heard.
Now, the one I heard about before I knew anything about the story of Smart Studios was Nirvana. People would say, you know, Nirvana recorded here at that little building on East Washington. What was their session here like, and how did they end up here?
They ended up here. What's interesting is they ended up here because of the local band Killdozer. That's what was a really interesting story that I began to hear from bands around, you know, why did Nirvana end up here? How did they end up in Madison, Wisconsin? And it was Butch's recording of the record 12 Point Bucks by Killdozer that ended up being heard by Jonathan Poneman at Sub Pop Records in Seattle. Sub Pop heard the record, loved the production, loved the work that Butch was doing, and began to send bands who were on in their catalog to Smart Studios. Nirvana was one of those bands. So Nirvana came in April of, is it 90 or 91? And what I've heard about the session was that it was short. They were tired. They were fresh off of a tour. You know, they worked long and hard. And I believe on the fourth or fifth day when Kurt Cobain was doing vocals, he blew out his voice. So they actually couldn't finish those sessions here. That's how they went. They went, you know, very similarly. The session went similarly to other sessions at Smart. You know, a band comes in for a few days off a tour. They bang out an EP. They bang out a full length, a single, whatever they want to record, and then they take off. I mean, that was not atypical for sessions at Smart Studios.
We're talking with Wendy Schneider right now. She's the director of the new documentary called The Smart Studio Story. It debuts this weekend in Wisconsin. And Wendy, do you remember any other stories from what it was like? Sounds like it was a pretty quick business. A band came in, they banged it out, and they left town. But do you remember any other stories like about Nirvana that caught your ear as a filmmaker as you watched, as you researched this film?
You know, it's interesting because I get asked a lot about, you know, what crazy, outlandish things happened over the course of, you know, Smart Studios' run in Madison that make the studio or the story behind the studio stand out. And what's interesting is that for me, as a musician, as an engineer, and as a filmmaker, I was really drawn to what was really unpretentious and really steadfast about the studio. I was drawn to the work ethic and the level at which anyone who worked there was willing to go to make a good record. That was something that, or the experience of that happening in recording studios is not as widespread as it used to be. I think that records are done differently now. There's less attachment to community. There's less attachment to space. So for me, what was profound, what was really profound about the story of Smart, and what I think is something that I continue to be drawn to, is that it was a very, very real, very accessible environment for musicians. And there was a level of dedication and a level of skill that was brought to each session that was priority, you know. And so it's not for me about the heroin overdose in the bathroom or sex on the console. I mean, I could tell you stories like that.
Wait, those things actually happened?
Well, the thing, you know, what I feel also is really important about recording studios is that there's a level of mystique and intrigue and mystery around the sessions that happened. What went on behind those closed doors? It becomes intimate. It becomes private. It's something that's like this isolated little, you know, world. It develops over the course of a week or 2 weeks or 3 months. And what happens in there sometimes stays in there, but the result of which we all get to experience.
Well, Wendy, I know that this documentary, it was a labor of love for you. I think I read you collected tape for 6 years or something like that. Why did you decide that you had to make this film to tell the story?
Well, I decided to make the film, or I decided to finish the film after so long being in the trenches with the material, because it was important. Well, it was important for me to get to the other side, or to slay the dragon, so to speak. It's seemingly insurmountable project for a very long period of time, until the Kickstarter came through, and then there was really some resources and support behind the work that I was doing. But I also felt that it was really important to honor the community of Madison, the work of Butch and Steve, other engineers, the music, the building, the scene, the history. All of that for me was valuable, and I felt a great respect for it. And I wanted to help encapsulate that at least as a launching of a narrative that was going to begin to tell one version of a story from this period of time.
And as we wrap up, why did the studio shut its doors?
That's a good question. Why does a studio, not necessarily SMART, but why does any sort of mid-sized to world-class studio shut its doors? You know, if you look at SMART's closing in 2010, you can look at it being on the heels of the economic downturn of 2008. You can look at the rise of the digital age and the accessibility of recording gear and recording equipment to musicians. Butch and Steve, after the success of Garbage, had moved to other cities and other states. Garbage was a big part of their lives at this point. So, you know, I think that it was a confluence of events and circumstances that led to the bottom line being something that everybody had to look at and say, can we keep it going? And the answer was no. In 2010.
Wendy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I really appreciate you having me.
That was filmmaker Wendy Schneider talking about her new documentary, The SMART Studio Story, which is screening at the Wisconsin Film Festival this weekend.
Coming up after the news, Food Friday regular Lori Skelton joins us to talk about meatballs. She's got some great recipes and cooking advice coming up. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll take a look at some of the biggest stories from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup.
First, Swedish meatballs, spaghetti and meatballs, vegan lentil meatballs, curry meatballs. Take some protein, mold it into a sphere, you got yourself a meatball. We tasked Food Friday regular Lori Skelton with trying a lot of different kinds of meatball recipes. She joins us now to share what she learned.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite kind of meatball? What meatballs did you grow up eating? And what's your favorite recipe or favorite way to serve them? What flavors do you like to combine in that meatball? You can call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Skelton is in studio now. She's one of our in-house food lovers, food makers here at WPR, regular guest here on Food Friday. Lori, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Give us Meatball History 101. Where do these guys come from?
You can find meatballs mentioned in Chinese literature as far back as 221 BC. You can find meatballs mentioned in Roman cookbooks in the 4th century. I think every culture out there has some sort of meatball. And the lovely thing about meatballs is, for the most part, they're something that's rather thrifty. You're taking some meat, usually it's animal protein, and you're extending it with bread or a grain of some sort, an egg. So it's a way to stretch, a pound of meat to feed a few more people. But I also think it is absolutely impossible not to be happy when eating a meatball.
Is that what you found based on your extensive research?
There's just something about having round, lovely, delicious things on your plate. You can't be solemn when you're eating food in a ball form.
Right, you even coined a phrase. I don't know if it's going to take off or not. We were talking about all the different things that can go into these, and you coined the phrase protein spheroid.
Because it can be animal protein. It can be vegetable protein. Your basic, I'd say a good ratio to start with, is a pound of ground protein and then, say, half a cup of dried breadcrumbs. And if you can eat eggs, add an egg to bind it or use an egg substitute. You start from there, and you are limitless in the herbs or spices you can put in, the blends of protein that you use. I was able to make a few recipes. And the more I researched, the more I realized I could go the rest of my life eating a different meatball each week and still not come to the end of it.
I would stand in line to buy the Protein Spheroid Cookbook, if that's the actual title. I love it. Let's jump into some of the meatball varieties that you made and see what sets them apart. Let's talk about some of the traditionals. Let's go with your basic Italian meatball. Now, we think spaghetti and meatballs. This is not really, I guess, and I know this from you, an Italian thing.
It's Italian-American. Mm-hmm. The Italians do eat meatballs, and they usually eat them as a separate dish after the pasta. It is certainly possible to have meatballs with pasta, but that's not the way most Italians will eat them. Italians do have very small meatballs in their Italian wedding soups. And in certain areas of Italy, they like smaller meatballs, say the size of a marble. And those will show up a lot in soups. Meatballs about 2 inches big, you'll eat those on their own with maybe a little bit of pesto or something on top. Spaghetti and meatballs, it is delicious, but that's our invention, not the Italians.
I'm good with it.
What about the part where you so often, it seems like, have to mix with your hands? Yeah. You really have to get in there and be committed. This is not something where you look very dainty as you're cooking.
Which is one of the reasons why meatballs are one of the best things to make with kids. You want to get your kids in the kitchen, throw all of the ingredients in a bowl, and tell them to mush it up. What I've discovered from a lot of professional chefs is that by mixing meatball mixtures with your hands, you don't overwork it. You want there to be a little bit of air, for the most part, in a meatball. And by using your hands, you get a better sense of when everything is combined well, but you also haven't overworked the meat.
So I think I've gone wrong. I do mix them by hand, but sometimes they end up with really either sticky, it's hard to roll, and they just stick to my fingers. Does that mean I've overworked them, probably?
Actually, what it means is you needed to have your hands moist before you started mixing, especially before you start rolling a meatball. Put a little water or maybe even a little bit of oil on your hands, and that should help keep some of the mess down. Either that or get your kids involved. They don't mind getting messy.
They look when I'm mixing meatballs, they're like, gross, just at the raw meat. So I think the window has closed on that, probably.
I guess for me, growing up, when my mother usually made spaghetti with a meat sauce. We didn't make a lot of meatballs in my house. The few times we did, though, that was, yes, gross, but it was the good gross to stick your hands in that.
So we've been talking the Italian meatball. Let's talk now about the Swedish meatball. What is it that makes a Swedish meatball?
This is a blend of usually pork and beef, so it's not one particular protein. And traditionally, it would be served with lingonberry jam and maybe even some pickled cucumbers. That's how they would do it in Sweden. Of course, in America, Swedish meatballs were very, very popular in the 70s to be served in a cream sauce or a thicker gravy and speared with a toothpick to be eaten at cocktail parties. And that's certainly how I know Swedish meatballs, because that's the type of meatball that my Aunt Kathy makes. And that's still the benchmark for me. It's not the fanciest recipe in the world, but I do love it. I didn't want to tinker with this one at all.
We've got that recipe up on the Central Time Facebook page. We're cooking meatballs today. We've got Lori Skelton with us on this edition of Food Friday. You can join in with your favorite recipes, your favorite kind of meatballs, with meat or vegetarian. You can call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Keegan on the line in Waupaca. Keegan, hi.
Hello. When my sister and I became vegetarians while we were in high school, both of us kind of missed having meatballs with the family. And my father actually set out on his own and created this meatless nutball, is what he refers to it as. And all that it is a bunch of nut flours or ground nuts formed into a meatball using a binder.
And what did he use as a binder?
In the past, he has used everything from banana to energy egg replacer.
Okay.
And he has put eggs in it because both myself and my sister are fine with eating eggs.
Okay.
Well,
go dad. And these are good?
Oh, they are great.
I can totally back Keegan up on that. Yeah.
Fooled people in the past.
Really? Well, Keegan, thank you so much. That sounds great. And Lori, you tried a not nut flour, but you tried a different vegetarian. I think a vegan incarnation,
yes,
right? With lentils, was it?
Absolutely.
And they were good.
Absolutely. I brought in a lentil meatball. It was a combination of what they call caviar lentils, those little black lentils, and quinoa. And here you would cook your lentils until they were almost soft, and then cook your quinoa until it was soft, mix it all up, and then take out about a third of that mixture and throw it in the food processor, and I'm quoting now, until it has the texture of wet sand. So this would help bind your meatball. You actually took out some of the ground protein or the textured protein and put it in the food processor to make it more of a paste. And this was served with a coconut fenugreek sauce. When I brought this to Wisconsin Public Radio co-workers to try, nobody said it was a bad meatball. And I don't know if I fooled anybody into thinking, oh, gee, it's just as good as meat. But I do know that the sauce was what made it. So if you are going to try vegetarian meatballs out on Friends, be sure you've got a good accompaniment to go with it.
So going along with what Keegan said, there are some really nice nut loaves that can be shaped into balls and baked, and they get really delicious. I worked at a restaurant that served that once, and I've also seen eggplant used to make meatballs.
Beans and legumes can be either chunky or, again, processed into a paste. Their sticky texture is a really great way to bind them up. But yes, vegetables, eggplant, potatoes are a good binder to start with a vegetarian meatball. Beets, squash, mushrooms, those are all good starters. If you are going to go the ground nut and seed route, as I'm sure Keegan noticed, you do need more of a binder. Has anyone out there ever tried blooming chia seeds? Those get kind of like a jelly-like, and I'm told that's a really great way to bind a vegan meatball.
That trick you mentioned, Lori, with the lentil one, and lentil and quinoa, of taking a portion of it and food processing it or blending it, that's also a trick you recommend for some meat, real meat meatballs.
If you are looking for a meatball that has a denser texture, I did experiment with, we've already talked about, you want to mix this with your hands so that this doesn't get too dense. You don't want the entire meatball to be this heavy paste. But if you are looking for something that has a little bit firmer texture, maybe you do want to skewer it with a toothpick, you might try taking out a third of your ground protein mixture, blitzing it in the food processor for about 15, 20 seconds, then mixing it all together to change the texture.
You know, I've tried baked meatball recipes a couple times, and they've kind of smooshed down in the pan. Maybe they weren't dense enough, so maybe this trick would help keep them in spheroid form in the oven.
And was this baked meatball recipe, you were only supposed to bake it? You weren't supposed to do anything else to it?
There's no pre-sear. Oh, I guess if I'd seared them first and then baked them, maybe
that
would have worked.
Which is one of the things that I think makes a meatball distinctive and certainly different from meatloaf. Proportion-wise, a meatball will have more surface area that's been exposed to heat, whether it's baked in the oven, whether it's seared. So right there, you've got that lovely caramelized, cooked texture on the outside to contrast with the cooked but not so rough texture in the middle. I'm not saying you can't bake a meatball, but yeah, if texture is an issue, you may want to experiment with just how dense your meat mixture is. Another good way to keep your meatballs from falling apart is before you roll them up, chill the meat mixture. Mix it up, then throw it in the refrigerator for 30 minutes, and then take it out, form it into meatballs, and bake it or cook or steam or broil or whatever you want to do.
We're talking to Food Friday Regular right now. Lori Skelton's with us talking about meatballs, and we want to hear from you.
What is your favorite take on the classic, the meatball? How do you like to serve them? What's your favorite kind of vegetarian meatball? What kind of sauce do you serve with them? Is there a kind of cuisine from around the world that works really well with this? Do you have a question? Have you failed in your efforts? Maybe Lori can help you out. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post in the Central Time Facebook page and pick up a recipe while you're there. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion about meatballs with Food Friday regular Lori Skelton.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up eating a particular kind of meatballs? Tell us about them. What's your favorite way to make or serve them? Do you think of them as an entree or maybe that appetizer with the toothpicks in them? Do you have questions about cooking? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to a caller now. We've got Myra on the line in Rochester, Minnesota. Myra, hi.
Hi. I grew up eating a meatball. My mom called it Target meatball, and it was a hard-boiled egg with the meatball around it, and you baked it, and then you just put ketchup over it. But I'm wondering, is there anything else you could put in there besides a hard-boiled egg?
Wow, interesting.
I've got a question. What ethnic background is your mom?
German.
She's German.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because that sounds to me like a Scotch egg,
yeah,
which would be fried, not baked.
Not baked,
I
yeah.
know in Pakistan and India, that's a popular way to make a meatball and serve it. I suppose you could get creative by putting something inside a meatball. To me, that's not really a meatball. To me, a meatball is all of a piece. If you want layers or you want striations, that to me is where meatloaf can get creative.
That's where you draw the line.
But I do know that there are ways to put a piece of hard cheese in the middle of the meat,
okay.
And if you're, especially if you're going to deep fry it, that's a good way to cook it, because for something like hard cheese or maybe a mixture of tofu in the middle of your other coating, shall we say, you want to be sure that's cooked all the way through. So you would, I don't know if baking would get everything cooked properly. I think that's why you need to deep fry. That'd definitely be something to check, but I guess I don't consider that a meatball.
Lori, did you deep fry any?
I didn't deep fry any. I did fry, but not immersed in inches and inches of boiling oil. I did fry, I simmered in sauces, and I baked when I was making meatballs this time around. And I like starting off, even if they're going to be baked, I do like starting off with just a little bit of browning, a little bit of a sear on top of the
I think
stove.
I'll try that next time I try a baked recipe. We're talking about cooking meatballs, vegetarian and with meat. Lori Skelton is with us on this edition of Food Friday. Still time for you to join in with your favorite recipes or questions about cooking meatballs at 800-642-1234. Lori, you mentioned earlier the recipe we have up on the Central Time Facebook page, Aunt Kathy's Meatballs. Give us a little more detail. Why are these such special dishes?
Well, these are the meatballs that my Aunt Kathy brings to potlucks.
Hence the name.
And for me, that means I get to eat them at Christmas time. So this is always something festive for me, even though it's not a terribly complicated dish. When she sent me the recipe, it turns out that this comes from a very old edition of the Feasting with the Fourth Estate, where various reporters and people from newspapers around the state would put together cookbooks that were sold to raise money. When I called the Manitowoc newspaper, the Gail Davey, who originally submitted the recipe, nobody there at the moment remembers her. So if any of Gail Davey's family is out there and wants to call in, I want to say thank you, because I have been loving those meatballs for decades. And it's very, very simple. It's beef and pork and parsley, salt and pepper, onion. And you make all your little meatballs about an inch big. You put them in a oven-proof dish. And then you take a can of cream of mushroom soup and mix it with some water. Pour that over the meatballs and bake for half an hour. And it's amazing.
Sounds great. Well, you know what? We've got another caller on the line. Now let's talk to Ralph in Sister Bay. Ralph, hi.
Are you there?
Yep. You're on the air.
Hey. This is Ralph Johnson, Al Johnson, Swedish restaurant up in Sister Bay.
Excellent. Hello.
And,
okay,
make,
so
Swedish meatballs.
Okay, from the simple ones we make at home, what do you do to yours, or aren't you allowed to say?
Well, no, I can say my grandmother brought the recipe over from Sweden, but funny enough, we use 100% ground beef. We don't mix pork, but my other grandmother, who stayed in Sweden, she, when I would go visit her, she used a blend of pork and ground beef.
Yep.
You had mentioned earlier about browning the meatballs. For years, since 1949, we would brown them in peanut oil and submerge a whole batch at a time. And only for about a minute and a half just to get that outside crust.
Right.
And then we would finish them off in a pot of gravy for about 3 hours in the oven. And then they get that, they still keep that crispiness on the outside, but it's nice, moist, and chewy on the inside.
And Rolf, I want to ask, Lori mentioned serving Swedish meatballs with something involving lingonberries. Does that happen?
Lingonberries, it's the only way to have them. Only way to have them. And, you know, you had a guy on there earlier talked about the vegetarian meatballs, and IKEA actually has a vegetarian meatball now, and I don't really care for it that much, but the sauce that they serve that you can buy at IKEA is a vegetarian cream sauce, if you don't mind having cream in a vegetarian diet. And it's an excellent, easy-to-make sauce, but the Swedish meatballs that we have, we use a thick brown gravy. And I've been working there since I was a small child. And every once in a while, we used to have a hard time getting the meat to stick together, depending on the humidity. And I called up Nuskies one time to find out if there was a trick. And we had done this for years. We'd fight by adding more egg. We'd fight by adding more bread. And what the trick was to first mix your salt and your beef stock with the beef before you do anything else. And then you add your final ingredients. And it's stayed together ever since.
Wow. See, when you said you called Nuskies, I thought you were going to say you added bacon to
it. I did too. I thought that's where I was going.
Because that is something I've tried. If you put a couple of slices of bacon in the freezer and then chop that very fine, you're adding a little bit of extra fat, and that will make the texture a little bit moister and certainly a little bit richer. So, wow, it's great to hear from you.
One more thank you, Rolf. One more quick call from Elise in Trempealeau County, other side of the state. Elise, hi.
Hi. The historic Trempealeau Hotel, which is right in Trempealeau, has a walnut ball. They also serve a walnut burger, but the walnut balls are meatless. And they are delicious. They serve them with, you can get salsa or a honey mustard. And they actually, you can buy the walnut burgers, or they do a walnut crumble that you can buy at a lot of the natural food stores around Wisconsin as well. So you can make them at home too.
Elise, thanks. I've had the walnut burger at the Trempealeau Hotel and here it, you know, bought in the freezer section.
Yeah.
So that there's that nut flour again, ultimately in the vegetarian meatballs.
And you don't normally think nuts and mustard, but that's a great combination.
Well, Lori, any final
tips,
advice for getting started with meatballs this weekend?
I made a batch of meatballs last week with nettles from my backyard. So if you can safely pick them, you do need gloves. This is a great way to eat your enemy in the springtime, to get rid of yard weeds. Go out, pick your nettles, throw them in a pot of boiling water for 5 minutes. That will blanch them, get them beautifully green. They'll be safe to handle. Squeeze them, chop them up, add them to your meatball recipe. I was amazed at how good nettles could be in a meatball. So give that a shot this weekend.
Lori, thanks. Good to talk to you again.
Absolutely.
That's Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house chefs, a Food Friday regular. She joined us this Food Friday to talk about meatballs. You can find a recipe for her Aunt Kathy's meatballs. They're linked on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, maybe share some of your favorites, link to your favorite recipes. Is it okay to text in movie theaters? The big boss at the AMC movie theater chain raised that question in an interview when he said the chain was considering the idea of allowing texting during movies as part of an effort to keep up with changing technology and appeal to millennial moviegoers.
But the official word came down today after a major outcry from the public. Here's a tweet from CEO Adam Aaron. No texting at AMC. Won't happen. You spoke. We listened quickly that the idea has been sent to the cutting room floor.
It's not surprising that moviegoers were not on board. In research on mobile phone etiquette from the Pew Center, and we talked about this here on Central Time a while back, 95% of Americans surveyed said, no, it's not acceptable to text during movies.
You're all for it, though.
You do it all the time,
no,
right?
No, I don't do it all the time. I think that it's really hard. If someone's sitting near you, all of a sudden there's their blue face glowing in the dark, and it just distracts you.
Yeah, that's the big problem. It's not like talking where everybody in theater hears it, but if you're behind that person with the lighting up screen, that's where it really gets. And there have been some PSAs, often with language. I found some that we just can't use at local movie chains, really hammering down on this texting in the theater
idea.
Yeah,
so maybe even millennials not into this.
Yeah, well, I don't know. We should ask our local millennials. Text to the theater? No, we're getting a head shake.
Right.
Nope, two head shakes from the millennials in eye contact. Let us know what you think over at the Central Time Facebook page, but not if you're watching a movie right now. This is Central Time.